Welcome to Food for Thought. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. I'm an author and educator dedicated to empowering people to make informed food choices, to debunking myths about veganism, to being a voice for animals, and to giving people the tools and resources they need to live according to their own values of compassion and wellness. I'm the author of The Joy of Vegan Baking, The Vegan Table, Color Me Vegan, Vegan's Daily Companion, and The 30-Day Vegan Challenge. And also, a new book of mine is coming out called On Being Vegan. You can find out about that and everything else at my website, compassionatecook.com. I also encourage you to check out the 30-Day Vegan Challenge at 30dayveganchallenge.com to participate or to buy a gift subscription for someone you love. And you can also find me on Twitter and Facebook, through which I share lots of inspirational, hopefully, quotes and blurbs that people can easily retweet or share with family and friends on Facebook. So follow me at Twitter at twitter.com, Patrick Gaudreau, twitter.com/Patrick Gaudreau, something like that. And on Facebook, facebook.com/compassionatecooks. Of course, before I get started with today's episode, first and foremost, I would like to thank my wonderful platinum members, James Killen of Incentive Personal Training in Australia. I have two Australian platinum members now that I think about it. James is at personal-training.com.au. Thank you, James. Anonymous in Norway. You know who you are. Thank you. Grace Rodriguez, Tim Anderson, David Cabrera, and Alexander Gray. Alexander Gray Associates, which you can find out more about at alexandergray.com. Peter and Eric of Peace Food Cafe in New York City. That's peacefoodcafe.com. They just opened their second location in New York City, and I'm so jealous and so excited for all of you who get to experience it. Chris Hanna of Propagandi in Canada. That's propagandi.com. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, Chris. Is it Propagandi? Is that how you'd want me to say it? I'm sorry. So it's spelled Propagandi. So P-R-O-P-A-G-A-N-D-H-I. Check them out. And Anonymous in Melbourne, Australia. You know who you are, and I thank you as well. As promised, I wanted to actually read Anonymous in Melbourne's beautiful, beautiful, thoughtful letter. I mentioned in the last episode that I would read her letter, and so I'd like to read it now. Dear Colleen, I hope you're well. I was gifted a silver membership last year, actually late the year before now, from my lovely partner and have decided to upgrade to platinum this year. I wanted to fill you in on some of the reasons for this. I've been vegan now for a year and a half, ever since I started listening to your podcast. They changed my life. People say that so much about so many things that it's become a cliche and often not actually true. In fact, I've written to you before and said exactly that. But even then, I don't think I fully understood how much your voice of hope and compassion started me on my own journey to be the change you want to see in the world. Being vegan is such a huge part of who I am now that I can barely remember not caring or not talking about animals. I know it's not the label that matters, but within that label is all that I have come to believe in. Veganism has changed the way I respond to people and to animals with more compassion and understanding than I ever could have imagined. I was never really what you would call an animal person. Even when I became vegan, I didn't want to contribute to their suffering anymore, but I was not someone who loved having animals around me. I didn't notice them very much. Perhaps it was because, growing up on a beef cattle farm, I had learned early on to ignore them because that was easier than acknowledging what was being done to them. And due to the hypocrisy of people's love of domestic animals, curiosity of wild animals, and total indifference and even sometimes disgust of farm animals, I avoided dogs and cats as a matter of principle. They also make me sneeze. Over the last year, though, I have found this has changed for me. I see animals now everywhere. I work at an organic fruit and veg store at my local market, and even the caterpillars and the bugs on the kale I'm fascinated by and want to rescue. My field of empathy has widened, and I cannot look at other beings now without imagining their little souls or hearts, or even just their basic impulse to live. I grew up in a country town surrounded by nature, but all I ever wanted was to leave and go to a big city and discover theater and art and culture and coffee. I love all of those things, and they're integral to our society. Well, probably not coffee, but I also cut myself off from something much deeper, a love, respect, and appreciation for the natural environment. It's the beauty and the wonder of all that is not us that really sparks my curiosity and imagination. When we can see outside of ourselves, anything and everything becomes possible. I always had the temptation to try and change others, to be right, to make them see differently. When I first became vegan, that was my instinct because everything was so painful and I wanted people to realize their responsibility to the planet and to the lives we so casually use and discard. But after listening to your podcast over the last 18 months, I realized that if you feel the world could be a more peaceful and loving place, you have to start with your own inner world. Because if you're not full of love and patience and compassion, you can't spread any. You've helped me see in all areas of my life that it's not about being right. It's about living your truth and having an open heart and mind, being an example of all that you wish the world to be. This is what creates real and lasting change. I think it's very easy to look at the world and see only pain and suffering caused by us. It's true, we are destructive animals. But when I live my truth and am gentle and patient with myself and others, I'm reminded of our capacity for so much more. I'm studying social work and psychology at university, and every day in class, I read about and am confronted with the worst of humanity. But I look around at the people I sit with and speak to, and I realize I'm also surrounded by the best, people who care so much and who live lives full of love and compassion. This gives me hope that things can change, that things are changing. Still, there are days when it hurts to think about people's apathy when it comes to animals. On those days, I listen to one of your podcasts and I feel everything will be okay again. I regather my thoughts and focus on being the love and being the compassion I so wish for others. I think when you choose compassion over detachment and anger, you open yourself up to pain. That's the hardest part of this journey, and it's what people try and avoid. But it's also the best part, I think. And I'm grateful for those days and for the sadness because it allows growth and understanding and patience. Feeling pain somehow gives me permission to not be so hard on myself and on others because life can be tough and everyone's doing the best they can in the circumstances they're in. For some time, I've wanted to give more to you because I believe that you are a wonderful guide and teacher and that people respond to your work. I wasn't in a position to do that until now. Quite simply, I believe in a better world and I want to contribute to that by supporting those who are trying to change it and also work towards building the animal rights movement as a social justice movement. When I finish my degree, I will be a social worker. And for me, that means more than just equality and justice for human animals. I read something written by a man named Paul Gorski. He works at George Mason University, and he wrote a piece called Critical Ties, The Animal Rights Awakening of a Social Justice Educator. It made me realize that I could combine my areas of interest and work toward a more open form of social justice that included animals. So this is what I want to dedicate my life to. As much as I don't believe in money and would prefer a very different kind of world than the one we live in, I figure as long as I have a little, I should try and do something with it that reflects my hope for the future. One of those things is to support what you do so that you can continue on your journey of compassion and wellness. As I said earlier, I've written to you before about my gratitude for my partner and her support of my own journey to becoming fully awake and aware. This journey has led me on a different path than the one I had imagined and changed some of the things that I had wanted for my future. Consequently, my relationship with her came to an end a few months ago after 4 beautiful years together. While it has been an incredibly painful time for both of us, our dedication to compassion and kindness has allowed us to part in the most gentle of ways, and for that I am grateful. Just after we had broken up, she gifted me with a 30-day vegan challenge because I think she knew that I would be living on my own and would probably not look after myself particularly well. Not that I would stop being vegan, but that I may become a lazy and possibly unhealthy vegan. She knows how much you have inspired me and helped me find my own path and how much I love to cook. I also think she wanted me to remember something we shared together that I believe brought us closer and made us each separately better people. We became vegetarian together and vegan a year later, a profound experience for us both. So it has been lovely doing the challenge and reading in the community section about how it has helped and changed so many people. I wanted to congratulate you on such a great program. So I know this was lengthy, but thank you for taking the time to read it. And thank you for all that you do for the animals and the people. That is so incredibly beautiful. Thank you so much for that email. I am so impressed by your insight and your sensitivity and your compassion. And I am so grateful for your generosity and your support. Thank you so much. Please stay in touch and keep me posted on the work that you're doing in this world. Thank you also to our gold members, new gold member Nicole Evall, renewing gold member Stephanie Helgeson, and new gold member Marjorie Miller. I'll be reading their letters in the next episode. Please remember that this podcast is 100% listener supported. Without you, people like Anonymous in Melbourne, and people like our new gold members, I would not be able to do this work. If you want me to spend time looking for corporate sponsors, I can do that. I can spend my time that way, but I don't think that's the best use of my time. And this has been the model from the very beginning, and I'd like to keep it this way personally. I know things are tight for folks these days, but if everyone listening just did their part by becoming a monthly or annual member or just donating anything, I can continue doing my part. So please consider contributing by becoming a monthly or annual silver, gold, or platinum member and help me continue to spread the message of compassion throughout the U.S., throughout the world. I mean, you see where the listeners are. They're everywhere, and this work is spreading and getting into people's hearts and changing minds and changing lives and hearts quite literally. And I'm very grateful for that, and I'm grateful for your support. Visit CompassionateCook.com and click on podcast and support the podcast. Thank you. So I decided to do this episode because I hear from a number of single vegans who would like to find a mate with whom to share their lives. And that's a pretty natural, understandable desire. Yet for vegans who want to date someone who's like-minded, they can also feel limited and frustrated because the pool is somewhat smaller than the pool that the general population chooses from. With vegans still representing only a small percentage of the population for now, it narrows the options somewhat in terms of finding someone compatible. And because the pool of vegans is small, it presents what some vegans feel is a dilemma. Dating non-vegans. Should I date non-vegans? And of course, with that comes its own challenges. So I thought I would share with you my own thoughts about this topic because it touches so many of us, including those of us who may not be single, but who want to see our single vegan friends manifest their desire to be paired up with a loving, compassionate, compatible partner. Now, I will preface this by saying that I did not experience the dating thing as a vegan. I was already with David, then my live-in partner, now my husband, when I became vegan. But when I met him, I wasn't eating land animals. I didn't call myself vegetarian because I wasn't. I was eating aquatic animals, and I was eating dairy and eggs. And though it was an ethical issue for me back then, I stopped eating land animals after reading Diet for New America. My impetus for becoming vegan, and at that point, pescatarian, I suppose, has always been for the animals, 100%. But it did not have the resonance or the power in my life until I became vegan. The compassion, the ethical aspect just did not have the resonance until I became vegan. That's just the way it is. Eating vegetarian, or in my case, pescatarian, just is not the same as having the full awakening, the full paradigm shift that we call becoming vegan. So the question is, would I have started dating David if I were already vegan and he was eating animals as he was when we met? I don't know the answer to that. I simply cannot answer that. But what I do know is that what attracted me to David was that he was open and loving and kind and intelligent and compassionate and thoughtful. And those are all pretty much the prerequisites for and the foundation of being vegan. Of course, when I met David, I did not realize I would be married to him today. We were both working at Barnes & Noble bookstore in Livingston, New Jersey, and I had been there for maybe 6 months already and was department manager when David was hired as a bookseller. And we laugh at this because I make it sound like I was in a position of authority when in reality, I must have been making maybe $7.50 an hour while he was making $5.50 or something like that. But I did get to tell him what to do sometimes. I told him what sections to shelve the books in and when to take his lunch break. And I held keys. Like, you know, you kind of had those keys around my wrist, you know. That felt like I was pretty important. So I like to tell the story that positions me as his boss, even though it's not true. But I was his department manager. He doesn't like that part of the story, but it is true. So when he started at the store, it was 1994, and he was 22 years old, and I would have been 24. And prior to his first day, all I knew was that this new guy was starting. A bunch of new people had, you know, were starting. And I think I knew that he was in graduate school for English literature, and I knew that he taught tennis. That's all I knew. So both of these things intrigued me in terms of having something to say when I met this new employee, but that was about it. That was about as far as I gave it any thought. So we worked together for a time, but it's not like we hung out. I don't even think we hung out in the break room because, you know, I was his boss. wasn't really his boss. But he was a nice guy. He was a shy guy. He was very quiet. He was cute, but I wasn't, you know, I didn't like have a crush on him or anything. I wasn't attracted to him in any other way than just, oh, he's a nice guy. And we talked a few times about this and that. I think we joked around about a couple things. And I learned very quickly that he liked to shelve books in the poetry and philosophy sections of the store. I knew that he pretty much kept to himself. That was apparent. And for me, in the meantime, I had passed the exams for graduate school for English literature, and I had applied to a couple small schools in New Jersey with the intention of getting my master's degree and eventually my PhD in literature and being a university professor. That was my intention. My intention was to first get my master's degree in New Jersey and then move to Santa Barbara, California, because I had fallen in love with California and Santa Barbara in particular. And I was going to transfer to UCSB, University of California at Santa Barbara, to finish off my doctorate studies and then pursue a teaching career in California. That was what I thought was going to happen. So a couple months after David started working at the store, I left the store. I quit to go work for a family, taking care of the two kids and, you know, picking them up from school and watching them until the parents got home. And I had done childcare before, and it was a better paying gig and one that gave me the flexibility to be able to focus on my studies. This was in anticipation of me being in school. So that's what I started doing. And someday I'll tell you about how I got into trouble for taking the kids to see Babe, the movie Babe, because it upset them too much, especially the little girl. She was 7 or something. It was a mainstream movie. I mean, I wasn't doing anything like underhanded, but I was told by the mom that them having seen Babe made it difficult for them to enjoy their hot dogs and hamburgers. And she knew I was not eating land animals. I wasn't, again, I didn't call myself vegetarian, but I was an animal advocate in other ways. I was volunteering at the local animal shelter. I was raising awareness about animal testing in puppy mills. I did feel very strongly about not eating animals, but I was still clearly blocked about consuming their secretions and eating aquatic animals. A couple of years earlier, I had worked in a local health food store, so I was already interested in nutrition. I mean, I was very interested in eating well. And so let's just say it was very difficult when I had to watch the amount of crap this family fed to their kids and feed it to them also, because that's, you know, that was my job, both in terms of the dead animals that they were eating and in terms of the junk food. So I got into trouble when I took them to see Babe. It was just ridiculous. And in fact, now that I think about it, even though I wasn't vegan then, I was definitely aware of the harmfulness of cow's milk, because I remember struggling with these kids every time they went to eat a snack. I mean, because they ate so much dairy-based ice cream. And I was always trying to give them healthier food. It was a battle between us, and it just didn't work. And I remember the mother saying to me one day that she let them eat a lot of ice cream because she felt it was giving them the calcium that they needed. So it was a very difficult situation working for this family. And let's just say it didn't last very long. So around that time, I found out that I had been accepted to the graduate program at Seton Hall. And I didn't know anyone else in the program except that guy, David, who I had worked with at the bookstore, who attended Seton Hall and was part of that graduate program. So I called the bookstore a few times to see if I could catch him while he was working and to ask him how he liked the program. And so a couple weeks went by and I just couldn't seem to get him while he was on shift. So I asked one of my former coworkers if she wouldn't mind giving me his home number. And so she did. And so I remember this very clearly. I called him up, maybe his mom or dad answered. I guess I don't remember it that clearly. I remember most of it very clearly. And he got on the phone and I said, you know, hi, I don't know if you remember me. Meanwhile, it had been like 2 weeks, but we worked in the bookstore together. And I remember that you were in the grad program at Seton Hall and I just got in and I just wanted to touch base with you. I don't want to bother you. I won't keep you, but I just wanted to ask how you like the program, you know, ask you a few questions and whatever. Well, who would have thunk it, but me and this shy guy from the bookstore, who I really did not have an ulterior motive in calling, talked on the phone for 2 hours. I had no idea we would have had so much in common and that we would have had so much to talk about. I just had no idea. So we talked for 2 hours and we made a plan to go to the Seton Hall campus a couple days later so I could check out the campus and acclimate myself to it. I'm reluctant to call it a date because it wasn't planned as a romantic thing in any way. It was just a way for me to see the campus and then we'd have lunch afterwards. So 2 days later, on Thursday, January 26th, 1995, David picked me up in his 1988 Oldsmobile and we drove to Seton Hall. We walked around campus and then we went to lunch. But here's the cute thing. I found out later on that the day before he came to pick me up, that we were to go to the campus and to lunch, David had taken a dry run to my apartment in Summit so that he would know where he was going on the day he was supposed to pick me up and not be late. Let me tell you, people, if you want major points with someone that you like in any way, friendship, romantic, whatever, that got him a lot of points. It was so sweet that he was so thoughtful and wanted to make sure he wasn't going to be late. So he drove to see where I lived so that when he picked me up, he was on time. And he was. So we went to the campus and then we went to lunch at the office bar restaurant in Summit. I used to go there all the time. And I remember getting my favorite appetizer, which was pretty much carrots and this ranch dressing that was good, not vegan because I wasn't vegan. And I don't know what I would have gotten for lunch. I remember loving their breaded fried gooey mozzarella sticks. Maybe I got the Caesar salad. I don't remember. And perhaps David got a burger or chicken fingers. Chicken fingers were a really popular item on that menu. But I do remember talking to him about film and philosophy and literature and sundry other topics. And after our phone conversation and now this lunch conversation, I started thinking, this guy's pretty cute. He's pretty cute. And I realized I wanted to see him again. And he was just sweet and kind and kind of adorable. And so I didn't think, oh, but he eats animals, so I don't think I want to see him again. If I had thought that, and if I had made that decision, I would have missed out on spending my life with the most wonderful person I could have ever dreamed of. So that would have been an incredible loss for both of us. What I knew was that I liked this person enough to want to see him again, just like when we meet any new person without the intention of creating a romance. I mean, there are differences when you're starting a friendship than when you're starting a romance. I realize that, but I think sometimes it need not be so different. I guess what I mean is that when we're developing a new friendship with someone, we're more relaxed. We cut the person a little more slack and we're less attached to what the relationship ultimately looks like than when we are meeting someone who we think is a potential romantic partner. We put so many expectations on that person and so much pressure on ourselves because we think it should look a certain way, or because we think we should be a certain way, or we think that person should meet a certain mold. And so what happens is we may write off someone more quickly and be somewhat more judgmental when there's a potential for romance than when we think someone will just be a friend, quote unquote, just be a friend. Now, I'm not saying to force something to happen if there's no connection or to keep going on dates with someone you don't like. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying that I think we're much more relaxed when we don't want to get something out of a situation, right? So when we meet someone who's like-minded, either through work or the gym or a shared hobby or through friends, we tend to be interested in who that person is and what they do and who they are. And we cut them some slack because we don't see friends as having to fit a certain mold. We're open to our many different friends, many different personalities and quirks. When it comes to someone we go out on a date with, we tend to be more wrapped up in who they could be to us rather than who they already are. And we come at it with so much baggage. I guess it's my long way of saying that, of course, I thought David was cute, and any of us in that situation starts thinking about possible future plans and hopes. I'm not saying that I wasn't. But just as when I meet someone for the first time as a friend who's not vegan, when I meet them, I don't write them out of my life because they're eating animals. And I didn't do that with David. Now, of course, there are differences, like I said, when we're talking about romance. And as I said, I wasn't eating land animals, and David was eating everything. He grew up like I did, eating everything, land animals, aquatic animals, animal secretions. But we started dating because there were so many things about him that I loved. I mean, we started dating because we were compatible in all these other ways. It was the core of who he was that I fell in love with. It was his heart and his mind and his sweetness, even though there was some behavior that I didn't love. Namely, that sometimes he'd come to my house smelling like Wendy's burgers. And I said before that if this were the same scenario today, I don't know how I would respond, but I wasn't fully conscious when he and I started dating. I had stopped eating land animals, but I was still blocked. So my emotional reaction to David eating animals was very different than the way I respond to someone eating animals today, or if I smell it today. It's very different. But the core of David is the same. And I imagine, and I'd almost bet my life on it, that if I had been vegan when we met, he would have been open to the information and I would have presented it to him right away. In other words, I wouldn't have been drawn to someone who was arrogant and insensitive and closed. Or if I was drawn to them initially, it wouldn't have lasted. It was David's humility and his sensitivity that led him to be open to the information several years later when I finally did become vegan and he followed suit not long after that. But in those early days, I do remember him coming over to my apartment smelling like Wendy's. And I was definitely turned off by that. Turned off because I thought it was gross, not turned off because I thought he was evil. And I remember that it wasn't just on his breath. This was so interesting. And I'm sure I told him to pop some cinnamon Tic Tacs to make the smell go away. But it was the smell coming out of his pores. He denies it to this day. He hates me telling the story. When I told him I was telling our story, he said very quietly, "Do you have to tell them everything?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, for the greater cause, I do." But he hates this part of the story. He thinks I smelled the burger wrappers that, you know, were in his car. That's not what I smelled. It smelled on his person. It was oozing grease and fat is what I smelled. And I have a very strong sense of smell. And I'm sure I smelled like that too when I ate animals, but you don't notice it on yourself. It's like a smoker who doesn't notice that they smell like smoke. It's only when they stop smoking that they can smell it so strongly on others. And that was the case here. I could detect the smell from the grease and fat coming out of his pores, particularly, really, probably only when he ate fast food. It was remarkable. I really do have the nose of a bloodhound, so it's not like I was sniffing him from head to toe in order to detect this. I have a strong sense of smell. But fat and grease are a detectable, identifiable smell. Now, by the time we knew that the relationship was serious enough, by the time we knew we were in love, I had told David that my plan was to move to California after graduate school. I mean, that was what my plan was. And this was only a 2-year program. And so I said that I was going to move to California. Why don't you see if you like California too? And so we organized a trip to California from San Francisco down to Santa Barbara to see if David liked California enough to consider moving there. And he did. And luckily, I had been accepted as a teaching assistant during my time in grad school. And so I taught English Lit 101 to incoming freshman students. So I got a really good taste of what it was going to be like to teach in academia. And in my first year of grad school, I was already writing proposals for papers to present at various academic conferences. I was thrilled when I was accepted to present at a conference in New York City. My paper was on cyclical patterns in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. My preferred studies were medieval literature as well as Shakespeare. So that's where a lot of my focus was. And then my second was on a panel at the MLA conference, the Modern Language Association conference in Washington, D.C., which David and I attended. So I was very quickly getting a taste of what life in academia was going to be. And I very quickly knew that I didn't want to build a life in academia. So by now, I was deeper into my animal advocacy. Yes, even though I was still eating their secretions and the flesh of fish. And I knew that I wanted to devote my life to combining my love of literature, my love of writing, my passion for and desire to help animals, and my desire to raise awareness about these issues and help people. I didn't know what it was going to look like. I had no idea, but I just knew that's what I was going to create. And also, David and I had both become jaded in grad school, realizing it was very political. It was all about publishing papers and competing with thousands of other graduates to find a position at a school to teach what I realized I just wanted to read and study. I didn't necessarily want to teach using someone else's curriculum. So that's why literature and the arts continue to play a huge role in our lives, in both our lives. They didn't become a vocation for us, but they remain an avocation. So we decided to work for a year after grad school. We finished grad school, work for a year and save money, and then moved to California. And by now, David was working in technology. I know, kind of skip ahead. He had left the bookstore and he was getting into technology while he was still finishing up his grad degree. By the way, his bachelor's degree was, he was a double major in both math and English. So he did have a science math-minded brain, or does. And so he was already in technology. And I got a job as an editor for a travel publication. And about 8 months in, we started looking for jobs in California in preparation for this move. He was looking for tech positions. I was looking for a position with any animal organization I could find. And we had also by then decided to move to the San Francisco Bay Area because A, two of David's friends from college had already moved to San Francisco by then, and B, it made more sense for us to go where technology was for David. And since I wasn't going to pursue my doctorate and thus wasn't going to go to UCSB, as much as I loved Santa Barbara, we also didn't want our closest city to be LA. We were much more drawn to the San Francisco Bay Area. So that was our decision. And I wasn't having a lot of luck finding a job with an animal organization. So surprise, surprise, David found a job. And the cutest thing I remember is when he flew out to California to interview for the job, he called me to tell me how it went. And the first thing he said was, I think you're going to like it here. There's a vegetarian diner in Berkeley with vegetarian meat, even vegetarian shrimp. Like, I remember that conversation. That was a long time ago. So David was already very sensitive to the fact that I didn't eat land animals. It was the first thing he said to me on that conversation, and I remember being pretty excited. That restaurant has since closed. Oh my God, what was the name of it? It was Michael's, for those of you who are in the Bay Area. It was that, I think it had been an old IHOP, and so it had that same design of those IHOP restaurants. So it was Michael's Diner, I think it was called. And then it became, maybe it's a Japanese restaurant now, I don't know. And it did close, but of course we have lots of other vegetarian and vegan restaurants in the area. So fast forward to July 1998, we had a going away party. We packed up David's new Mazda 626 with our suitcases. And our Mazda 626, by the way, just died. It was almost 20 years old and almost 200,000 miles on it. And it just died, completely died. But we packed up that Mazda 626 with our suitcases. And the company that David was working for moved all of our other belongings out. We packed up Simon and Schuster, my cats. And we drove across the country to Oakland to an apartment we had secured a month before. We literally drove from Route 80 in New Jersey to Route 80 in California, like literally one road across. David had his last bit of animal flesh at an Arby's restaurant somewhere in the middle of this country. And I remember stopping at this restaurant and him going to Arby's for some gross burger. I remember giving him grief about it. And I went to Taco Bell for the bean tacos. Not that they weren't gross, but I mean, they were bean tacos, better than an Arby's burger. And less than a year later, I read Slaughterhouse. And that's when I felt like I had been punched in the stomach because the pain was so great. And I woke up completely to the violence against animals. I became vegan. And 6 months after that, David followed suit. What's very interesting, particularly about a guy becoming vegan, and in this case, I think becoming vegetarian too, is, you know, especially after his girlfriend or his wife becomes vegetarian or vegan, is that there's a perception that they're doing it for her. And that when she's not looking, he can cheat or sneak animal products, right? I find it incredibly sad and insulting, as if David has no mind of his own. And we did encounter this a little bit, especially from friends who had known him all his life, being, you know, consuming animals. I just think it's ridiculous. I think we come together to inspire each other to be better people in this world. I think that's why we all come together, whether it's platonic or romantic. We come together to learn from one another and teach one another to become better people. I listen to music now that I hadn't listened to before David turned me on to this music, but it doesn't mean that music isn't something I embrace or love or listen to when he's not looking. It's not like I'm faking it. He brought it to me and it became mine too. David wasn't into film before he met me. I turned him on to film and now he's a film fanatic like me. And it's an authentic interest for him. He's not faking it. David didn't become vegan for me, nor did I convert him, as some people say. I was inspired and moved and changed by some things I had read. And I asked him if he would read these things too. And he said, yes. I brought him the information, but it was the information itself that moved him. I was just the messenger, as I always say. So David happened to be in the right mindset and it was the right time for him to experience a shift, just as it had been the right time for me when it happened. Now, I know it doesn't always happen that easily for everyone, and I know this is a struggle for some couples, and that's kind of a different episode, but prior to David becoming vegan, he was a kind, loving, open, thoughtful, compassionate person who ate animals. And once he became vegan, he was, or is, a kind, loving, thoughtful, compassionate person who now manifested those values by not eating animals. So perhaps what I'm saying is, in searching for our partners, we don't focus on the effect of those values, i.e. being vegan, we focus on the values themselves. In other words, perhaps we don't wish to the universe that we want to meet someone who's vegan. Perhaps we wish to the universe that we meet someone who's kind, compassionate, thoughtful, open, and loving, right? And because that's who they are, the chances that they'll be moved by information that you might bring to them or share with them will be that much greater. So I guess in a roundabout way, I've answered the question, do you think vegans should date only vegans? I don't. You might have a different opinion or desire. That's fine. You might be a vegan who draws that line and says, I'm dating only vegans. And maybe you found a vegan partner that way and you're living happily ever after. Fantastic. I think that's fantastic. I'm not saying vegans should date non-vegans. I'm just saying I'm not sure it's best to write off dating non-vegans. I think not only does it mean you're potentially eliminating a fabulous person in your life, I think you're also limiting your options. As much as the population of vegans is growing, we're still a small segment of the general population. And so by the time we narrow that pool down based on gender and age and compatibility, we're swimming in a very small pool. Now, certainly there are ways to meet vegans. As friends or romantic partners, you can do this intentionally using, there's vegetarian vegan dating websites, there's veggiedate.org, veggieconnection.com, veganpassions.com, and ethicalsingles.com. And just to be clear, I don't have a personal experience with any of these. I'm just passing along the resources that I'm aware of. You won't find me on these places. I told David, that'd be so interesting if I did my own field work in this area. I won't. I'm not going to do my own field work. So you can use traditional matchmakers. In fact, one of our podcast listeners is just that. She is a matchmaker. Her name is Judith Gottesman. It's Gottesman, and she is the West Coast Jewish community's matchmaker and is especially sensitive to vegans and dietary preferences when making matches. You can find her at soulmatesunlimited.com, so you could use a traditional matchmaker. Other ways to meet vegans, you can go to vegan meetups or even green meetups. For instance, there's vegan drinks taking place in many cities around the world. You can even start one yourself. There's also green drinks, which you might be able to find like-minded people at. Certainly for sundry reasons, you can get involved with vegan and animal rights groups, local animal advocacy groups. It's a great way to meet people in general, not just potential romantic partners. Some activists in some cities do vegan speed dating, I've seen. So that's an idea as well. You can consider taking some veg-only vacations. I've heard, frankly, quite a few people who've met on such places as the Holistic Holiday at Sea Cruise that I just presented on. Go to atasteofhealth.org. There's also Veg Voyages at vegvoyages.com, which currently specializes in vacation tours in Asia, particularly India, Thailand, and Indonesia. The people who run Veg Voyages are fabulous, by the way. There's also Green Earth Travel. It's greenearthtravel.com, and they have specific vegetarian and vegan destination tours to Italy, to different parts of Western Europe, to Africa. Some really awesome things there. Who knows? Maybe they'll do a single vegan tour somewhere. I have no idea, but ask them, and it's just an idea. It's not a guarantee that you're going to meet, you know, your romantic partner on these vacations, but, you know, it's just one of the ways that we can meet people. Of course, you can ask your friends to keep an eye out for a single vegan man or woman they might meet or work with. You can wear one of my many joyful vegan t-shirt designs. You can walk around town and watch the other joyful vegans just swarm around you. Okay, maybe that's more of my hope than what might actually happen. But still, having a joyful vegan shirt will help you when you attend any of these things, because then people will say, oh my God, that's an amazing shirt. Where did you get that? And it's a great conversation starter. Or my Words to Live By shirt. Just saying, had to throw that out there. But if you do decide to explore dating a non-vegan, of course, there are considerations. And I know some of you have had nightmare experiences, and I know there are people who just say, I'm never dating a non-vegan again. That's your prerogative. I get it. If that's where you're at, that's fine. But things to consider, certainly. For a first date, even for the first few dates, I wouldn't recommend going out to eat. I think it's just adds a lot of pressure for a number of reasons. I think it's a lot easier to just go out for a drink or meet for coffee or tea, or even go for a walk in a park, you know, a public park. Don't go into a, you know, like a park at night with a stranger. It's just a lot less pressure and less of a chance that you're going to be exposed to someone eating animals in front of you right off the bat before you've kind of processed things with each other. When it does come time to eat together, by then I would imagine you will have already stood proud about declaring you're being vegan so that you can recommend the restaurant. You know, you can recommend a vegetarian restaurant so that you can enjoy a meal together without seeing someone consume animals right from the start. Certainly, if they've just had a meal that contains animal flesh, I mean, you know, I know smooching is an issue for some folks. And it was for me. Like I said, David didn't get a smooch until he brushed his teeth or he had some Tic Tacs. So, you know, you can draw that line. You don't have to, because people are like, I don't want to kiss anybody who's just eaten meat. Well, then don't. I mean, it's kind of simple. You don't have to. But truly, all of the suggestions I've ever made for being a joyful vegan just in life apply here. And I do think the way we characterize our veganism, whether we're proud of it or not, whether we're unapologetic or not, whether we're judgmental or non-judgmental, I think the ways we present ourselves makes a difference in terms of how someone responds to us. As I always say, there's a fine line between speaking your truth and expecting a particular outcome. So while I do think there's nothing wrong with saying that you're vegan early on in the meeting process, please do. You have nothing to hide, and your being vegan is a manifestation of how compassionate and sensitive you are. I do think we need to allow the person we're saying that to a little time to process it, especially if they don't really understand it or if they've had negative experiences with someone in the past. I think some vegans can have the attitude when dating non-vegans that just says, I'm vegan, and if you have any problem with it at all, then we're not compatible. Probably because they've had some negative experiences with non-vegans. So I get it, but being proud and vocal about being vegan is what I recommend, but also being sensitive and compassionate to the other person, I think, is also important. Now, that doesn't mean that if you say you're vegan to a date and they react with horror or hostility, that you have to continue dating them. I'm not saying that. I'm simply making the point that how we represent our veganness can affect how someone responds to it. I know there are horror stories out there, people who are resistant and defensive, who start arguing right away when you say that you're vegan or immediately have judgments against veganism. If that's the case, what I said before applies here. It's not because they're not vegan that makes them incompatible to you. So when we just write off non-vegans, it's not because they're not vegan that makes them incompatible to you. It's because they're closed and resistant and judgmental that makes them incompatible to you. And that's what will turn you off, period. I don't know if that makes sense. It makes sense to me. So where I do think there is a bit of difference in engaging with non-vegans as a potential romantic partner is in online dating. So there is a difference between kind of meeting someone in person, because when you're meeting someone in person, you can kind of gauge things organically and naturally. And, you know, you might know someone through someone else and they'll have already told them that you're vegan, or you you meet them at work and they know that you're the vegan at work. And so it's just a lot more natural and it's slower and it's more organic. I do think there's a little bit of a difference in online dating through websites that are not just specific to vegans, so general dating websites. And there are vegans who use these websites. And obviously, you don't just have to use the vegan ones. Many people want to use the generic ones because it expands the pool. So whereas meeting someone in person allows you to have this more organic getting to know each other, especially in terms of the communication skills that we use and the cues that we use to express ourselves, and we can gauge the response of the other person. With online dating, it's very different. You're actually representing yourself in a two-dimensional space through checkboxes and flat descriptions, and there's no opportunity for nuance and inflection and body language and facial expressions, which makes it harder. I had a long conversation with a friend of mine about this, about how to designate that you're vegan in your profile on a non-vegan dating website. And it was very interesting because she had worked really hard on her profile and modified it as time went by, and she became kind of more versed in how these dating websites worked, and they all vary, they're all a little different. And she said that a number of guys who were interested in other aspects of her profile, and of course her lovely photo, said straight out, I'm not going to date you because you're vegan. Now, I think it's kind of a shame, because in some ways, even those people, those guys, they might surprise themselves if they met her and realized, oh, she's great, you know, that whatever negative experiences they had had maybe with some vegans in the past would realize that she's not those people and that she's different and, you know, what have you. But I just think people have so many blocks and misconceptions about what vegan means, especially before you meet a joyful vegan, that if you just see the word vegan next to someone's profile, it just reinforces those blocks in someone. So in an attempt to get around these blocks while still being honest about being vegan, because of course that's the essence of and the core of who she is, of course she would want to say right up front that I'm vegan. You know, there's so many misconceptions. It's this kind of double-edged sword. She rewrote her profile to indicate that she was a vegan interested in health and wellness or something like that. But then she got a number of very fitness oriented and health only, not ethically minded vegans. And, you know, she's an ethical vegan. And they weren't interested in animals, and they just weren't like-minded. They were just more fitness-oriented. So they weren't necessarily the right fit for her, even though they were open to her being vegan, and she was open to dating them even though they weren't vegan. But when she just put ethical vegan or vegan for the animals at one point, she said, that also doesn't represent the whole story, because people have these stereotypes about what that means, that you're militant and that you're hardcore or whatever that means, but that you're militant, right, and aggressive if you're ethical vegan. So we talked about a way to phrase it in her profile that spoke to who she really was and that she was vegan, and that was maybe in a way that someone could hear it better. You can't guarantee this. I'm just suggesting there may be ways that we can do it so that someone can hear it. And I suggested maybe saying something like, because I'm a caring, compassionate individual, interested in taking care of myself and being kind to others, I manifest those values by being vegan. Mm-hmm. Or I live according to my values of compassion and wellness by being vegan. So it kind of puts it in context, something that indicates that your being vegan is a manifestation of your values of kindness and wellness and compassion. So you're absolutely saying up front that you're vegan, but in a way that might be better received by the people reading your profile. In short, as my friend said, online dating is all about whittling people out up front so that you don't waste your time by the time it comes time to make the date. So I do support people saying up front, of course, in your profile that you're vegan, but I think it can be said in a way that represents all of the joyful aspects of being vegan. On that note, my friend had a lot of really great advice about navigating around these online dating sites that she preferred to vegan online dating sites, like I said, because it was just a larger pool, and because in some of these online dating sites, she knew a lot of people. She had already dated them or seen them or knew them in her area. So that also wasn't the right fit for her. She's very active in the vegan community. If you're in an area where you don't know any other vegans, this would be a great way to meet people, going to the vegan-only websites. But in terms of the non-vegan dating websites, she shared her thoughts with me about the ones that she liked best. She started with eHarmony. And she said they ask you a bunch of questions and match you up with the people that you have the most in common with. She said the only problem was that she would occasionally be matched up with a hunter or a fisherman because they also, quote unquote, liked camping and the outdoors. So that was problematic. She also used Match.com, and she said she had a lot of dates on Match, but she only did it for a few months, but she did like Match.com. Then she moved on to OkCupid, OkCupid.com, and she said the site is free, but you could pay a small fee and have more control. She said she paid the fee and that it was worth it. She had the most dates through OkCupid. And she said maybe it was because she was more, quote unquote, experienced at the online dating thing. She definitely emphasized that she got better at navigating these sites and kind of really utilizing the profiles and the features they had as she did them and she spent time on them longer. So that was something she really said made a big difference. The longer she spent time on them, the better she got at them. And also she said that what she liked about OkCupid.com was that the site has like up to 2,000 questions or more that you answer at your leisure. You don't have to answer them all at once. And then you could review other people's answers to get to know someone. So they just try to get a lot more detailed and nuanced. Interestingly, one of the questions in this long list of questions is, would you date a vegan? So that's all I've got. I hope that's helpful. The friend that I'm talking about in these dating websites really wasn't me. I'm not talking about myself. It really was my friend. So I thought that would be helpful for you. And I know that it can be frustrating. I know some of you have had heartbreak. I know some of you have had a hard time finding a like-minded partner, but please don't despair and certainly don't compromise your values just to please someone else. I've heard some people say that they started eating animals, or they ate animals in front of someone because they thought that, well, if that's what I have to do to find someone, then I'll do it. And that's not okay. Be proud of the compassionate person you are, and that's what you'll attract. In fact, I'd like to share something with you that I heard a long time ago about finding a partner. I think it was Marianne Williamson that I learned this from. She talked about the fact that so many of us are waiting for the perfect partner to come along. That we have this list of attributes this person has. You know, they're kind, they're compassionate, they're giving, they're trustworthy, they're loving, they're smart, they're funny, they're talented, they're successful, whatever. We have this list of what that person looks like. And she suggests that once we have this list, and most of us have this list, then we write out who the perfect partner is for that person. And that's what we focus on. Instead of focusing on who the mate is that we're waiting to appear in our lives, we actually show up as the perfect match for that person that we want. Does that make sense? In other words, she suggests that it's not that the perfect partner hasn't shown up, it's that we haven't shown up. That we focus instead on being the person who will attract our ideal partner in being our authentic selves, and we focus on what we can give rather than on what we can get. One of my favorite quotes from her is that it's not our job to look for love, but rather to look for all the barriers within ourselves that we've built against it. So when we're focused on just being this, you know, love in the world, it opens us up to experience the depth and breadth of relationships, of love for everyone that we come in contact with, whether it's platonic friends or strangers or family or potential romantic partners or every critter who crosses our path. In other words, to change a quote that we're all familiar with, be the love you wish to find in this world. And when that's what we focus on, we can't but experience it, and it will come our way. For the animals, both human and non-human, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.